inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the show today. Very special show today because it's our 1 year anniversary of Conversations Live. Now, I know I've been around KKNW a bit longer than that, but it's actually 1 year today that we aired our first show, Conversations Live. And we have a great guest for you. She is living proof that you can do and become anything you want. She's now an award-winning author and mystery novelist. Three best-selling books have climbed as high as number two on the New York Times bestseller list and stayed there for several months. But before becoming a writer, she was the captain of a sword boat, and that career earned her a prominent role in Sebastian Younger's The Perfect Storm and a portrayal in the subsequent film. Her name is Linda Greenlaw, and I'll introduce her in just one moment. But Eric tells me we have something special to play first, so... What is it, Eric? Well, he has a big old grin on his face.
You know, Vicki, you mentioned last week that this would be the 1 year anniversary of the show. And boy, it just flew by really quickly. And what a great year of shows it's been. So I thought it would be nice to go back through some of the shows and find one of my favorite clips to play from the program right now. So if you don't mind, I'll go ahead and do that.
Go ahead. I'm trusting you.
See, I remember it as if it was yesterday. It was not that long ago. And...
Welcome to Bride's Head, Mr. Ryder.
It's the most beautiful house I've ever seen.
How kind you are. And what form do your pleasures take?
What I most want to be is a painter.
We must get you to paint something for us.
I'd be delighted.
Mr. Ryder must stay with us for the rest of the vacation. You seem to me a very reliable young man.
See, it was just one of my favorite clips from the show because all those kind words that were being said about me, and I... Of course, I'm kidding. That wasn't from the show. That's from Bride's Head Revisited, which is coming out soon.
Good movie.
But the character is actually Charles Ryder, which is my dad's name. So, but it just kind of fitted with what we do here. And the fact is, there were so many clips from the show, so many favorite moments over the last year that it wouldn't be fair to actually just pull out one of them because it's been, you know, like I said, a great year. So congratulations and thanks for indulging me a little bit here at the
top
of the show.
Well, thank you. I thought you were going to pull out all my goofs. That's what I thought you were going to do.
We'll do that on the 2 year anniversary.
But that was a very appropriate clip because, of course, we could not have done all this without you, Mr. Ryder. So we do thank you. And
I'm a very reliable young man.
You're a very reliable young man.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thanks. I appreciate that, Eric. It was a nice thought there. And my guest today is very inspirational, and I wanted to have an inspirational guest today. She's somebody who's walked her own path and maybe done things that other people thought weren't possible. As I said, she was a sword boat captain, and that career earned her the prominent role in Sebastian Younger's The Perfect Storm, and then the portrayal in the movie that followed that. Her name is Linda Greenlaw, and I'd like to welcome her to the show. Welcome, Linda.
Well, thank you so much. I'm pleased to be part of your one-year anniversary today.
And we're very pleased to have you here. And you've been featured, I know, on many TV shows, Good Morning America Today, CBS Sunday Morning, Martha Stewart Show. And I'm wondering how you got to this point from being a sword boat captain. And maybe we should go back even further than that and say, why be a sword boat captain in the first place? Because I remember reading that your mother wasn't too happy about it. There had been talk of law school when you graduated. What prompted you to go to sea?
Well, I spent my early childhood trying to catch anything that swam or crawled around the shores surrounding my home. And, you know, when kids were learning how to ride bikes, I was learning how to row. When 10-speed bikes were all the rage, I had my first 10-horse outboard. So at the age of 19, I desperately needed money to pay my way through college, and I signed on as a deckhand on a commercial sword fishing boat. And back in 1979, there was a lot of money in commercial fishing, and it worked out real well. I fell in love with my life. I fished my way through school, and yes, much to my mother's dismay, after I graduated, I did take my degree offshore and continued with it for many years.
Yeah, and you wrote in the book that you're always amazed that women are amazed that you became a fisherman, and in particular a sword boat captain, because you're gone for long, you know, extended periods of time out to sea. What's the typical response when people find out what you've done in the past?
Well, quite often it is amazement. And I, you know, I think gender really hasn't been part of the equation. I think if you think about people in general going offshore for 30 days at a time, these very, you know, relatively small boats during hurricane season, it's amazing that anybody does it. I don't think it's amazing that a woman
right.
would do it.
Right, right. And I know you did stress that in your book, that you've never looked at, you know, you say you're a tomboy. My mother was a tomboy, so I can definitely relate to that. It doesn't stop you doing anything. But I do know, I was talking with a friend at the weekend, and she said, I just could not imagine the hardships that you must have gone through. But having read the book, I mean, this was so much who you are. It just was life, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I mean, it's definitely a lifestyle. It's a way of life I fell in love with. I like the way I feel when I'm at sea. I am passionate about catching fish. So it all worked for me. And as I said, gender really, you know, was not an issue. I never even gave it much thought until I started promoting my first book. And then, you know, was, you know, hearing questions constantly about, well, you know, what's it like being a woman in that world? And I thought, gee, you mean as compared to being a man? I'm not really sure.
Mm-hmm.
I like to think that the obstacles that challenge commercial fishermen are things like bad weather, poor fishing, mechanical breakdowns. I mean, those things obviously are ignorant of gender, so they were no tougher on me than they were for the men that were in the business at the same time.
Right. What was it you most loved about being at sea, Linda?
I was just, it's really tough to describe. And I say, well, I like the way I feel when I'm at sea. And then people say, well, how does that feel? I don't know. It's just something about throwing the lines off the dock and knowing that you're going to be, you know, obviously very self-sustaining unit, this boat and a handful of crew members. It's very much like living on an island where I live, and that is what appeals to me about being on an island, just mm-hmm. being self-reliant, self-sufficient, very independent. It's a great way of life.
Mm. And you grew up on the island, right? Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
Yeah. So what did your parents do? I know your father wasn't a fisherman. He became a fisherman. He actually worked with you when he was retired. But what did he do for most of his life?
My father was a shipbuilder.
Oh, okay. So ships were there no matter what.
Right, exactly. You know, if you live on the coast of Maine or off the coast of Maine, there's no way around having something to do with the salt water.
Right. Now, you were at sea for, I saw two different numbers, 15 and 17 years, so I'm not quite sure, but it was a long time you were a sword boat captain.
Yes, I think it was actually 17 years that I captained. I didn't captain the sword fishing boat all those years. I started when I was 19 years old. I worked on deck. After I graduated from college, I started fishing year-round and worked my way up to the captain's chair. You know, the last 10 or 11 years of my commercial sword fishing experience were as captain. And when I sort of retired from sword fishing, I started inshore lobstering, and I am currently still involved in the inshore lobster fishery. I fish my own boat. Much smaller boat and not offshore for 30 days at a time. It's pretty nice. It's a different way of life altogether.
Mm. Now, I'm curious. Well, I'm not curious because I read the book and I read all of the material that came with it. But I would think most people are curious how you got from being a fisherman to a writer. To me, they kind of, I think a lot of writers are really into nature and big, wide, open expanses. So there's nothing there to me that doesn't connect. But how did you get to write your first book?
Well, it was an opportunity that was handed to me because I was mentioned so generously in Sebastian Junger's book, The Perfect Storm. Mm. That book was on the top of every bestseller list on the planet, and I started getting phone calls from publishers in New York saying, hey, we've read The Perfect Storm. We're intrigued with this female fisherman thing you have going on. Do you want to write a book? My first reaction to that was, no, I love my life. I like this female fisherman thing I have going on. I never had aspirations of writing, although I majored in English in college It was because I enjoyed reading, and I figured that would be a way that I could get through school. I didn't take any creative writing courses. So it's an opportunity that just landed in my lap, and I had to take it very seriously. I had friends who would kill for the opportunity to have a book published. They're beautiful writers, and they can't get anyone to look at their stuff. So, I mean, how lucky am I that I was handed a great opportunity? And then the work started.
The work as in writing the book, you mean?
Yes,
which is the hard work.
I'm used to working very hard because I've been fishing since I was a kid. But I have to tell you, writing my first book was the most difficult thing I've ever done in my life. It was such a discipline to sit down every day and write. Really tough.
Well, I think when you're used to being active and when you're used to doing physical work, it's very hard to keep your butt in the chair long enough to write. That's always been a struggle for me. Did you find that was a struggle?
Yeah, that was absolutely the biggest part of the struggle, was keeping the butt in the chair. I'm a morning person. I'd get up in the morning and, you know, be committed. I have to sit here for 4 hours and write. And I did that every day for a year, and that resulted in my first book. And, you know, it keeps going on. I mean, I've just had promoting book number 6 now, and, you know, that's probably the most difficult thing I've ever done, writing the most recent book, Fisherman's Bend. I mean, it doesn't seem to be getting easier for me.
Well, you went from nonfiction to fiction, and even though some people think that there's not much of a transition, there can be an incredible transition there for some people.
Yeah, it was a transition. I'm fortunate that, you know, that you write about what you know. So even my works of fiction are very salty. I know boats. I know fishing. I know these small coastal communities. I know the people. I love the people. And that is what I write about. That's what I've written in my nonfiction, and that's what I've carried through into fiction. I've met, you know, so many people on the promotional tour who have said, oh, God, you know, I wish you were still writing nonfiction. I really don't enjoy reading fiction, but I guess I'll try one of your books. And, you know, my answer to that is, if you enjoy my nonfiction, I think you'll enjoy the fiction, because it's my voice, it's my style, it's my sense of humor, and the subject matter is somewhat the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I definitely want to get into that later. I'd like to look at, we mentioned The Perfect Storm a few times here, and obviously, you know, there are probably people out there who have not heard of that, even though it was, you know, number one bestseller for many years and then, or for many months, and then George Clooney played a part in that film. But just recount that story for us very briefly, if you would. What happened with The Perfect Storm and how that came to feature you?
Okay, it was quite a terrific ocean storm. It was originally known as the Halloween Gale of 1991 and became later known as The Perfect Storm, and Sebastian Junger wrote his book about it. Basically, there were a group of independent sword fishing boats fishing east of Newfoundland, or east of the Grand Banks of Newfoundland. And one of the boats, the Andrea Gale, was in a very bad place at a bad time. And it was very unusual. Weather in this hemisphere moves from west to east. And in the case of the Perfect Storm, there were 3 low-pressure systems, one of which backed up, went from east to west, and 3 low-pressure systems came together, forming this awful storm. And Andrea Gale was on the radio one night. The captain of the boat, Billy Tynan, and I had a conversation typical of any conversation I would have with someone west of me. The Andrea Gale had been steaming towards the dock for 3 days. These are relatively slow boats, or 10-knot boats. So he was, let's say, 600 miles west of the fleet that was still fishing, halfway home. And he wanted a fishing report from me. I wanted a weather report from him. And there was no indication that he was in any trouble at all. You know, he said, you know, the weather was bad, but, you know, hey, talk to you tomorrow kind of thing. And as opposed to what people may have seen if they did see the movie The Perfect Storm, there was none of this screaming back and forth on the radio.
Right.
Well, nothing was ever heard or seen of the Andrea Gale again after that last conversation. There was a weather buoy in the Andrea Gale's last known, sort of in the vicinity where they're last known to be, that recorded 100-foot seas. So,
wow.
I mean, it was obviously a very devastating storm, and, you know, I don't think the men of the Andrea Gale really had much of a chance in 100-foot seas.
I can't even imagine 100-foot seas.
I can't either.
Terrifying beyond, but I would have died of a heart attack, never mind anything else. So from that, Sebastian Junger wrote his book, The Perfect Storm, which was nonfiction, and that obviously featured you pretty heavily in there because you were one of their colleagues. You were a pretty integral part. So you spent 17 years at sea. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'd like to look at what happened then, why you moved to back home to the island, and the next leg of your interesting career. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
Seven seas, swimming them so well. Glad to see my face among them, kissing the tortoise shell.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Coming up on Conversations Live, look out for stories of real people who are changing lives and making a difference. We'll be talking with naturalist and adventurer Craig Childs. We'll be talking with the mommy millionaire who went from stay-at-home mom to CEO of her own million-dollar company. And we'll be speaking with world travelers who shed light on faraway places and our very own heartland. Please join Vicky every Monday at noon for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Find out more about upcoming shows at conversationslive.net or call Vicky at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Commune with the Pop Oracle on the Radio 8 Ball Show. I'm Andras Jones, the host of the Radio 8 Ball Show, where we answer your questions by picking songs at random and interpreting them as the answers, like picking musical tarot cards. That's The Radio 8 Ball Show on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Don't miss The Radio 8 Ball Show, Fridays at noon, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150.
The search is over. You found the station that's not afraid to be different. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Seas, swimming there so well.
And welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest today is Linda Greenlaw. Her best-selling books, three of them have climbed as high as number two on the New York Times bestseller list and stayed on there for several months. But before becoming a writer, Linda Greenlaw was captain of a sword boat. And we've just touched on that a little. And now, after 17 years at sea, Linda has a little career change. So why don't you tell us about that, Linda? Why, first of all, did you decide to stop sword fishing?
Oh, a couple of different reasons. The first of which is that government regulations were making it increasingly difficult to make the living that I had been accustomed to making, running this boat, the Hannah Bowden, which is featured in The Perfect Storm. And another reason is that I was in my late 30s, and had been offshore for many years and saw all my friends married with children and thought, oh, you know, it's not too late. I really need to get off this boat and move home, get ashore, settle down, you know, find the right man. And the only problem is that I chose my home, Isla Ho, this little tiny island where there are three single men. I say in the Lobster Chronicles that two of them are gay and the third one's my cousin. That is not very far from the truth.
Yeah, so maybe you didn't really want to get married that much.
I guess I didn't. I mean, that really wasn't planned out very well. But I do enjoy living on Isla Ho. I have a great life fishing inshore for lobsters. It was a good move in that, you know, I could still, you know, make my living at sea. Mm. Inshore lobstering is totally different from commercial sword fishing industry. It's a day fishery. You know, you leave the dock in the morning and you're back that afternoon or that evening. You get up in the morning, if it's blowing 40 or 50, you can pull the covers back over your head. You know, you're not sort of stuck at sea.
Right.
It's very nice.
Right. Now, your first book was called The Hungry Ocean, and that documented 30 days at sea when you were sword fishing. This other book, The Lobster Chronicles, documented your life, some of your life as a lobster fisherman and island life. And it was quite funny in parts. I mean, there was one bit where you said, you know, you had to question your wisdom or words to that effect, because here you were in your 30s and your mum's making lunch for you every day. So there were, in addition to going back home and, you know, that sense of comfort, there's also, I would guess, a little discomfort there, because you were used to being so very independent. So how quickly did you adjust to being back on the island with your parents?
Well, you know, the big adjustment of just being home wasn't all that tough. I mean, I have a really close family. I adore my parents. But there were just little things. For instance, I did find myself at my mother's kitchen table, like, for every meal. And apparently I had developed some poor table manners 17 years at sea. I mean, little things like that. I mean, when you're on a commercial sword fishing boat, I mean, you're sort of accustomed to wrapping your left arm around the plate so it doesn't, you know, slide off the table. And you hold your drink in your left hand and you shovel with your right hand about as fast as you can go. So my mother was constantly saying, Linda, let go of your plate. It's not going anywhere. Slow down. It's like, oh, yeah, you know. So it's more or less just the small things of not being on a boat constantly. That was a bit of an adjustment.
Mm. And tell us about some of the challenges of island life. This was another bit that made me laugh, because you say you some time ago had gone to see a fortune teller, and she said that you always needed to be liked, or words to that effect. And then you talk about somebody on the island when you'd first moved back, and you're actually hiding from her rather than confront her about something.
Yes, that's Rita, and it's interesting. When I was writing The Lobster Chronicles, my editor called me. I was about three-quarters of the way through the writing of this book. My editor called and said, Linda, you can't possibly love everyone on that island. I mean, you have no credibility here. Isn't there anyone that is a little strange or you dislike? And I said, oh, yeah. So I started writing about Rita, and I sent it to my editor, and he's like, you can't say that about people. So, you know, a lot of it got edited out, but basically, you know, a crazy woman and some crazy situations. But it was actually, you know, it's kind of fun. Rita's not on the island anymore. She's moved off to the mainland, and, you know, it's not the same place without her.
Mm. Oh, it's the characters that make places like that, for sure. Now, there are about 70 people there year-round, is that right? Or
yes, we have 50 year-round residents.
Uh-huh.
And in the summer, like the month of August, the population goes up to somewhere between 250 and 300, because they have a large summer community.
Mm. And some of those people you rarely see throughout the year. You said at one point that you kept seeing the same five faces every day at the shop.
Yes, exactly. We have one small general store on the island, and the stores only open 3 days a week and only for 2 hours each of those days during the winter months. So you think, well, there's 50 people on the island, but I see the same five people every day at the store. I don't know where the other 45 people are hiding.
Mm.
People kind of go into hibernation and come out in the spring.
Mm. And is fishing the mainstay of the economy on the island?
Yes, it is. Every year-round family is supported solely or mostly with lobster fishing, with the exception of... We have one school teacher. We have a one-room schoolhouse, kindergarten through eighth grade, 7 kids in the school this coming year, 6 boys and a girl. You know, so it's just like a kind of mini community. It's nice.
Right, right. So you had no fire department. I'm assuming you still don't. You had no medical facilities, although at one point you did train some EMTs. And you're about 7 miles off land, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. We have a volunteer fire department, but up until about 6 months ago, we had no fire truck. So a lot of good the volunteers, you know, would do if there was ever a fire. I think we'd have to just get in our boats and watch the island burn. Mm. And no medical facility. That's right. The closest hospital is a 30-minute boat ride and then a 30-minute ride in a car on a very bad road. So, you know, if anybody's in dire need of medical attention, they have to wait a while.
Right, right. And you talked about committees when you moved back to the island because you were, you know, the swordboat captain. So your word was law and you gave out instructions and the crew carried them out. And one of your challenges that you wrote about in the book was the frustration of having to deal with committees and how slowly they moved. And you talked about them voting and then re-voting. And it's no different in the city because we've had the same issue in Seattle voting on our metro system. So how did you cope with that aspect of things? Because it is very different when you've got, you know, full reign of everything and then you're having to deal with committees.
Yeah, I'm just laughing to myself a little bit here and thinking, how did I cope with it? I think I coped with it by not joining any committees after one really bad experience. Is total avoidance. Total avoidance. Oh, you know, it's, you know, every issue that comes up, you know, there's a winning side and a losing side, but the losing side never gives up, you know. A few months later, there it is on the agenda again. We're having another town meeting, it, you know, over and over and over and over.
Right. Now, as a lobster fisherman, tell us some of the challenges that you face on a daily basis. I mean, it's hard work. It is hard physical work.
It is hard physical work. I enjoy physical work, so I sort of thrive on it. I enjoy it. The sort of challenges are more or less if the weather's bad and you do go out and haul. You know, weather's always a factor when you're aboard a boat. That's the biggest challenge. If the weather's bad and you still want to get through some gear, it takes a lot longer. It's more difficult to do it. It's more dangerous. The other challenges are, oh, let's see. Gear wars. There's this threat of, you know, I really want to fish over there near this other island, but if I put my traps over there, they're probably going to, the other fishermen are going to cut them away. It's very territorial. Mm. I have a license that says I can fish all of Zone C in the state of Maine, which is a giant area, but history and tradition don't allow me to fish any more than basically the west side of the island where I live. If I wander off any farther than that, which is always a temptation, I lose traps, and it's very expensive.
Mm, so really those like fishing waters, if you want, those little territories are passed down through generation. Is that how it works?
Yes, for the most part, that's how it works. If a group or a family or a small community fishes a certain area, they're very strict about maintaining that area and keeping outsiders or interlopers out of their area. When I first moved to Isle of Ho, I thought it would be a huge struggle to fish among the Isle of Ho fishermen because I was a new gal in town, and I thought it might cost me a bit of money. I thought I might lose some gear. But as it turned out, nobody bothered me, and I don't know if that's because I had a reputation as a sword fishing boat captain, and they were all very aware of what I had been doing for 17 years, and maybe
don't
that
mess
was a
with
way
Linda.
Of paying my dues. You know, that may have been a way of paying my dues,
right.
Or it was, this woman's crazy, stay away from her. Or maybe a combination, I'm not really sure.
Right. Now, your father, when he retired, he helped you with your lobster boat. He was a sternman, right?
Yes, that is correct. My dad retired, and about the same time I started inshore lobstering, so my father became my stern man. And that's changed a little bit through the years. Now when my father steps aboard the boat, I move to the stern.
Ah, I bet.
I am the stern man now.
He likes that better, right?
He likes it better, and I don't blame him. I mean, he's 78 years old. And you know what? I'm a great stern man. If I'm in the stern, my dad can basically drive the boat, and I can take care of the rest of the work, so...
Right, so I know
the whole thing works better that way.
So while you're on book tour, as you are now, he is it, right? Or do you have help?
He is the guy when I'm on book tour. He's running my boat, and there's a young islander who's going with him. So he has a great stern man now. And when I get home, August 7th, I don't know if my dad will allow me to come aboard or not. I think it depends on how the fishing is.
Now, there was a point in your book toward the end of The Lobster Chronicles where you, I'm not going to say you were questioning the sanity of what you'd done, but everybody second guesses things they've done. I don't believe them when they say they haven't, really. But you were kind of wondering, you know, you wanted to find a husband, you wanted to have kids and build this lovely home and have, you know, everyone move in as a unit. And you were kind of questioning if that would ever happen for you. How are you feeling now about that?
I'm no longer questioning it. I know it's not going to happen. So the question mark is gone. But, you know, I've just kind of come to the realization that, you know, I have a good life. I have a really nice man in my life. We're not going to be married. He lives in Vermont in Onilaho in the summer, and it's a bit of a long-distance thing. He does his thing. I do my thing, and we're together. We have a great time together.
Mm. Well, that's what it's all about, right?
Yeah, it seems to be.
Yeah. So are you writing another book right now?
I am not. I have one more book to write in this Jane Bunker mystery series. It's a three-book series. And I have a title, and I have some ideas, but I've not had an opportunity to sit down and write. I have to wait until I'm off of book tour. And when I go home on August 7th, as I mentioned, I'll have to become very committed to writing the book, and I'll just sit down every morning.
Mm. Now, I know your mother was very much against you being a sword boat captain. So how does she feel that things have turned out now? How does she look, you know, when she looks back in retrospect?
Oh, my mom is absolutely delighted now. You know, for years, I listened to my mother, you know, give me advice about getting a real job, you know, when I was fishing, and saying that, you know, commercial fishing isn't really a place for an educated young woman. You're wasting your education. That's what I heard constantly, was that I was wasting my education. And I'm very quick to say that my education has never been wasted. I mean, I don't think it's possible to waste education. Mm-hmm. I use every bit of my education every single day, whether I've been fishing, writing, book touring, or just hanging out with my friends. I don't think it's possible to waste it. So I'm very quick to tell my mother that was the worst advice she ever gave me.
Yeah, I remember you saying in the book that you don't like it when people say education is a tool, because there are very specific tools that have very specific purposes, but education is meant to be used every day.
Exactly.
And I don't think you could do what you did for 17 years and be successful at it if you didn't have some education there. It would be kind of scary.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, there's a formal education. 1 + 1 = 2, and, you know, I before E except after C, things like that. And those are just the building blocks. I mean, I think my incidental education, or the things that I've learned working on the deck or in the wheelhouse of a boat, have been, you know, just as valuable as the lessons I learned in a classroom.
Now, I think one of the biggest challenges must be working with different people. And obviously, you get certain people around you who you work with on a more consistent basis. But you've worked with many different crews over the years. And as somebody who admits you don't like conflict, how did you resolve situations when they cropped up? Because everyone's living in such close quarters. It's human nature that there are going to be conflicts there.
It is human nature. And oh, I mean, if you could see me, everyone's first reaction when they meet me is, whoa, we thought you'd be a lot bigger. So I'm not like a great big Amazon woman. I've never felt comfortable thinking about stepping between two, you know, 250-pound men who are swinging fists at one another on the deck of a boat. My only tool, you know, to use as a disciplinary measure, has been, if this behavior doesn't stop, it's going to cost you a lot of money. So it's been the power to write the paycheck, which has really been pretty good about keeping everybody in line. You know, yes, you know, you're getting very little sleep, you're living like animals, you're working like slaves, you may or may not be making any money, because that's the way fishing goes. Nobody wants to go to sea for 30 days and not have every dime they have coming to them. Mm-hmm. So just the threat of, you know, losing part of a paycheck has always been enough for, you know, the fist to be dropped to the side.
Mm. Well, tell us how that works, Linda, because the boat owner gets a chunk of change, right? And all the expenses are taken off that before you even see a penny, is that right, of your haul?
Yes, it's called settling up, and every boat has sort of a different settlement. You know, the owner decides how he's going to do it, and that's the way it is. And you should always check what the settlement is before you go on a boat so you know what's in store at the end of the trip for, you know, the money that you're going to receive. But basically, we all work on a share basis. The expenses, the running expenses of a trip, which are bait and fuel and gear and groceries, light sticks and things like that, are all considered the running expenses. For instance, the end of my sword fishing, it would cost generally around $40,000 to get the boat off the dock.
Wow.
So there's $40,000 invested in a trip the minute you throw the line. So you have to catch 10,000 pounds of fish before anybody makes a dime. Mm-hmm. That's if you average $4 a pound for fish.
Mm-hmm.
And then the expenses are taken off the top, and then basically the rest is divided in half. Half goes to the owner of the boat. The other half goes to the captain and the crew. So it's a share system, and my old boss used to say, we share the good and we share the bad. And right now, we're sharing the bad.
Oh, that's not good.
You didn't really want to hear that when he's handing you the envelope with your pay in it, but
right,
unfortunately, it's part of the deal.
Yeah, and you guys have been busting your butt for 30 days out at sea.
Right.
Well, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Linda Greenlaw. Her latest book is called Fisherman's Bend, and we're going to talk in the next section about some of her mystery writing. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
I'm at sea again, now you're hurricane.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Hi, I'm Vicki St. Clair and wanted to let you know about Book Talk, a weekly podcast brought to you by Conversations Live. In Book Talk, we'll be reviewing books from the eclectic to the banned to the challenging and, of course, to the easy and fun summer beach read. You can download Book Talk podcasts at 1150kknw.com under the podcast section of the site. If you'd like to be a guest reviewer for Book Talk, call me, Vicki, at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617. Or drop me an email at info@conversationslive.net.
Hi, this is Howard Bono, the host of The Money Thing, heard right here on Tuesdays at noon. You don't need to know everything about money, but there are some things you really should know. Each week, my co-host Gary Mance and I will bring you the information that you need. We cut through all the verbiage and marketing hype to provide you with an hour of condensed, easy-to-understand information. We want to improve the quality of your life by taking the financial stress away. So join us for The Money Thing, Tuesdays at noon, here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Open your ears, open your heart, open your mind. Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And my guest today is Linda Greenlaw. She's an award-winning author and mystery novelist. But before becoming a writer, as we've discussed, she was captain of a sword boat, and that career earned her a prominent role in Sebastian Junger's The Perfect Storm. She then moved to, the island of Islaho, which is just off Maine, and is became a lobster fisherman. And you've written 6 books altogether, I think. Is that correct, Linda?
Yes, that's correct. And you didn't butcher the name of the island at all.
Oh, okay, good. And your website, that's what I wanted to give out. I was having a little brain cramp there. Your website is lindagreenlawbooks.com. And if you look on there, if our listeners look on there, they can see some of your books, and they can also get a couple of recipes off there. and which I'm going to try. You also write a cookbook with your mom, right?
Yes, my mom and I co-authored a cookbook, Recipes from a Very Small Island. And it's a beautiful book. I'm very proud of the cookbook. It was totally my editor's idea. He came to the island from New York City to visit one time and found himself at my mother's kitchen table on, occasion of every meal. And he sort of jokingly said, oh, you two should do a cookbook. And my mom and I both said, oh, yeah, right, that would be fun. And then, like, 2 years later, he sent us a contract. I was like, Mom, are you in? I mean, do you really want to do this? And she said, yes, absolutely. And my mom was 70 at the time.
Oh, wow.
And it was really, it was neat. I've always had opportunity to work with my dad, and having something like this gorgeous cookbook to do with my mom was really special.
Well, how could you live on an island off Maine and not write a cookbook? Come on.
Yeah, I know. That's what I tell people. You know, there are no restaurants on the island where I live, so everyone has to cook. And the recipes that we have in the cookbook are actually very cookable. You know, there are no very exotic ingredients by the nature of where we live. I mean, I go to the general store on the island. You don't go with a list. You go with an open mind.
Interesting. So tell us the name of your cookbook.
It's Recipes from a Very Small Island.
Oh, very appropriate. Recipes from a Very Small Island. So you've written these three nonfiction books, and I'm not quite sure in what order you wrote your cookbook there, but then you turned to mystery fiction. So tell us how that began for you.
Well, when I wrote my first book, The Hungry Ocean, nobody was more surprised than I was when it was very successful. And the publishers, Hyperion, said, hey, you know, this is neat. Do you want to write another book? And at that point, I said, yes, I would like to write a novel. And they said, no, actually, your audience is nonfiction. And they gave me a two-book deal, the first book being what they wanted, which was The Lobster Chronicles, about the inshore lobster fishing industry and life on Very Small Island, and then this untitled novel. Well, then the untitled novel was pushed aside for another nonfiction, All Fishermen Are Liars, and that was pushed aside for the cookbook. And then finally I was on the hook to produce this untitled novel. Had no idea where to start, and my editor and agent suggested that a mystery would be a good place for Linda Greenlaw to start and break into the fiction.
Mm. So tell us a little bit about your character. Her name is Jane Bunker. I read that she's nothing like you.
Well, and I must have written that because everywhere I go, it's actually pretty funny. I was in a bookstore last night ready to do a talk, and the woman introducing me said, Jane would be happy to sign books after she speaks. It's like, no, it's Linda. Jane's the character. So I say Jane Bunker is not Linda Greenlaw. The jury's still out. We do have a lot in common for the simple reason that you write about what you know. Mm. Jane Bunker has to know a lot about boats, fishing, and small coastal communities. So I know my works of fiction are very salty. But having said that, writing in the first person, it was difficult, but I did make a huge effort to make sure that Jane Bunker did not become Linda Greenlaw. Mm. We do have some things that are absolutely nothing alike. For just a small example, Jane Bunker is very frugal. I mean, she is a cheapskate. And I am not. I am the other end of the extreme. I mean, I throw money away. I am, like, generous to a fault. So that was, you know, one way of, one, making Jane kind of quirky.
And how hard was it for you being generous to get into her head as a tightskate?
Well, actually, I think I did a good job with it. It's, you know, stretching the imagination muscle. And that's something that I didn't have to do that much with my works of nonfiction. I mean, I know the story of sword fishing. I know the story of inshore lobstering. But do I know what it's like to be a cheapskate? Well, I can imagine what it's like. And mm-hmm. that was a great deal of fun for me.
Mm. Now, you said for the first time you had to actually outline because, as you said, you grew up on the sea. You spent most of your adult life on the sea fishing. So that came second nature to you. But when you're writing the mystery novel, you actually had to go down to outlining. Tell us what kind of process you used for that.
Well, that was a bit of a learning curve. When I was writing my first mystery, that's Slipknot, and that's the book that was published last year, when I started writing that book, I did not start with an outline. I just dove right in and started writing, knowing that I had to really get going. And after like seven chapters, my editor called me and said, hey, you know what? I really think you need an outline. And he was right. I had a dead body on page one. 100 pages later, I didn't know who did it, why, or how. I didn't seem to care. I was just writing up a storm.
That's called the organic approach.
Exactly. Well, you know, I could have, you know, written 1,000 pages, and I still wouldn't have reached the end of the book. So I did have to outline the plot at that point, and it really, you know, obviously streamlined the process of writing the rest of the book. So when I wrote Fisherman's Bend, I started with the outline, at least outlining the mystery part of it. Mm-hmm. That made it a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. So Jane Bunker was a Miami detective, moved to a town in Maine, where she was sure that life would be quiet and peaceful, but obviously it wasn't, right?
that's correct. It wouldn't have made much of a book to have her move to a very quiet and peaceful town. She moves to Greenhaven, Maine, which is a fictionalized Stonington, Maine, which is very close to where I live. So it was easy for me to sort of set things up. I mean, I know the town of Stonington well enough that I could, you know, have Jane moving around and seeing things the way that I would move around and see them in Stonington. And yes, I obviously outlined the plot, and you know, it's a lot of work, but I'm very happy with my book.
Mm, and you said, we talked about this earlier, that you would write in the morning before you went out fishing. How many hours a day would you write?
I've always written 3 or 4 hours a day when I'm working on a book, and I, you know, every single day, 7 days a week, 3 or 4 hours, and that seems to be about as much as I can do. And after that, I'm very happy to throw the pen down and, you know, hop aboard the boat and go haul some lobster traps. Hauling lobster traps at this point in my life is quite mindless work. So the whole time I'm hauling lobster traps, it's physical. I like being on my boat, but I'm able to think about my writing.
Yeah.
To the point of when I sit down the next morning to write, most of the time I've already, you know, constructed maybe the first paragraph in my head.
I think when you do work that you know very well, physical work that you know very well, it becomes almost meditative, doesn't it? And it allows you that space, as you said, to just create without even maybe thinking of it consciously.
Yeah, it absolutely does. It seems to work very well for me, and I know it does for other writers as well.
Yeah. Now, I have to ask you, because I read in your, I believe it was in the Lobster Chronicles, that the people on the island had been very nervous about you writing your first book, The Hungry Ocean, because they were afraid the island was going to be flooded with people. Were they a little less nervous about you writing fiction?
Yeah, they were absolutely less nervous. And as it turned out, they were nervous, you know, for no reason. It's a tough place to get to. We're not all that hospitable. There's no restaurant. You can't even get a sandwich. So you have to really want to get to Isla Ho to get there. And, you know, we did not receive, like, droves of people coming to look for Linda Greenlaw. So, you know, the worries were for naught.
Mm. So where do you see yourself going? You said you have another novel to write, but where do you see yourself heading over the next few years, Linda?
Oh, boy. You know, I really have been thinking about this a lot because, boy, I've got one more book to write, and I'm done with my contract. What will I do? I don't know. I suspect that I will continue writing in some way. Do I want to do A Hungry Ocean, too? I'd love to go sword fishing again for a season and write about that, like sort of back in the saddle again kind of book. Or would I like to do, I've had a very eventful 18 months on Isla Ho. Would it be fun to do another Lobster Chronicles because there's tons to write about on the island? I'd love to write children's books. I really like children's books, and I would love to write some. And I will, you know, always be fishing in some capacity. So I suspect I'll be hauling lobster traps and writing something.
Mm. Well, I told you before this show started, I was supposed to be somewhere this weekend and I chose not to go. And so I took The Hungry Ocean and I took The Lobster Chronicles down to the beach Saturday and Sunday. And I just read all day. And it was great beach reading because you have a nice voice. And it's all about the ocean, and I was right by the ocean. So
I think you picked the perfect place to read my books.
I did. Now, what other profession? Let's talk about that, because you're only in your 40s. What other profession would you have liked to have tried?
I can't imagine doing anything else, and I have you know, in the last few months been wondering, well, let's see, if I don't have an opportunity to write another book, I really can't make enough money lobstering to sustain this nice lifestyle that I've achieved with my successful books. Man, what if I have to go find a job? What can I do? It's pretty scary. I don't think I'm really qualified to do anything.
Oh, well, you could say that about both things that you started out and you became very qualified. But, you know, you said that the lobster fishing doesn't supply a decent standard of living anymore. Is that because it's saturated right now? Because there's always...
No, the fishing is still very good around Maine. I mean, we have some laws that other states don't have to protect the resource, and it's been successful. The problem right now is that the expense of going is so high because the price of fuel is high, sky high. It's higher than it's ever been. Diesel fuel for the boats is, you know, it's over $5 a gallon. And because the fuel is high, the bait has escalated. It's double what it was last year. And because those things are higher, the cost of the gear is higher. So everything's more expensive, but the price of lobster has not gone up. And it can't, really, because, you know, lobster is such like a luxury food for a lot of people who come to Maine. They'll eat lobster once a year. Mm. They make this trip to Maine to eat lobster. And if it gets too expensive, they'll have something else.
Right, right.
So, you know, there'd be no demand. And then, of course, the price would go down, you know, somewhat, I would imagine. So
right.
We're kind of a little bit in a bind right now. And we're hoping for a really very successful fall. Usually the fall is our best season, and it's hard to catch enough lobsters to compensate for the big expense, but, you know, we're hoping it's going to happen.
Mm. Now, over the years, you've known a lot of people who've lost their life fishing or sailing backwards and forwards between the island and the mainland. You became obsessed, you said, with why do some people survive and why do some people not when they're given the same situations, the same circumstances? And you talked in specific terms about some islanders, five people who went out, two survived, three did not under the same conditions. You became obsessed, you said, with finding out why some people do survive. Did you come to any conclusions on that?
I didn't really reach any huge conclusions on that. That specific incident that you're talking about, you know, a small boat capsized, the water's very cold, you know, three people, you know, hypothermia right away, died, you know, almost immediately, and the other two people lived in there in the water all night. The statistics say they should not be alive. Why did they live? But, I mean, I never reached any conclusion about that, but people have voiced their opinions to me that haven't I been lucky to have survived all these years of commercial fishing. And, boy, I hate to think that luck has anything to do with it. I mean, if I believed that luck had a hand in my survival, I'd have to believe that my luck would change. I wouldn't dare go to sea.
Mm.
So, I mean, I'd like to think that it's something done right in the cases of, in most cases of boats going down. The Coast Guard always does, you know, an investigation, and they can usually point a finger at either the vessel was unseaworthy or, you know, somebody did something wrong. Somebody made a mistake.
Yeah, I made a bad call even.
Right.
So looking back on the past 20 years, what do you know now that you wish you'd known when you first started out?
Oh, gosh. Can you believe I've never been asked that question? That's going to take some thought.
All right. Well, maybe when your next book comes out, you can answer that.
Okay, I'm going to be dwelling on that. I'm going to be thinking about it all night. Can you call me back tomorrow? I'll have an answer for you. I promise.
So what would you like to leave our listeners with today, Linda?
I think just that maybe the title of my first book, The Hungry Ocean, you know, it's from a Shakespearean sonnet. And I've learned through the course of my travels that the title means different things to different people. But, you know, to me, the title refers to the ocean's ability to totally consume. I have been fishing since I was 19. I have been consumed by it. I know it sounds cliche to say that you're drawn to or taken with something, but I like the way I feel when I'm at sea. As proud as I am to be sort of noted as a best-selling author, nothing makes me prouder than to say I'm a fisherman.
And we're very proud to have had you on our one-year anniversary show today. Thank you for joining with us and sharing some of your journey. It's been very interesting.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and I want to just remind our listeners that they can find you at lindagreenlawbooks.com. And Linda's latest book is called Fisherman's Bend. That's her novel. And also check out The Lobster Chronicles and The Hungry Ocean. Check out her website. Everything's up there. And I want to thank you for joining us today. We do appreciate you tuning in. Thanks to the J&B Group for their continued support and to the wonderful Mr. Ryder over there. And we will see you next Monday at noon. Thanks for being with us.
Coming up on Conversations Live, look out for stories of real people who are changing lives and making a difference. We'll be talking with naturalist and adventurer Craig Childs. We'll be talking with the mommy millionaire who went from stay-at-home mom to CEO of her own million-dollar company. And we'll be speaking with world travelers who shed light on faraway places and our very own heartland. Please join Vicki every Monday at noon for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Find out more about upcoming shows at conversationslive.net or call Vicki at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617. Views expressed on the